As for the girl whom the king had betrothed to his brother, whom Pheroras, as I said before, had not taken, being ruled by his wife, Salome had asked for her on behalf of her own son by Costobarus, and was inclined to marry her to him. But she was talked out of it by Pheroras, who said the young man would not be well disposed toward her because of his father's death, and that it was fairer that his own son, who was heir to the tetrarchy, should have her. In this way he begged forgiveness, and even without gaining it acted as if he had. So the betrothal was transferred, and she was married to Pheroras's young son, the king providing 100 talents as her dowry. The troubles in the household did not let up but kept growing worse, and something of the following kind occurred, arising from a cause not at all respectable, yet advancing far because of the ill will it stirred. The king had eunuchs whom he prized greatly for their beauty. Of these, one was entrusted with pouring his wine, another with serving his dinner, and another with putting the king to bed, men trusted with the greatest responsibilities of the court. Someone reported to the king that these men had been corrupted by his son Alexander for a great sum of money. When Herod questioned them about their dealings and intimacy with Alexander, they admitted to it, but said they knew of nothing else troubling toward his father. Under torture, though, as the pressure grew more severe and his agents kept intensifying it to gratify Antipater, they began to say that Alexander bore hostility toward his father and an inborn hatred for him. He had, they said, advised them that Herod should be given up as a lost cause. A man who had already had more than his share, and who used the darkening of his hair to disguise his age, hiding the proof of how old he was. If they would only pay attention to him, once he had won the kingdom, which, whatever his father wished, could belong to no one else, he would soon hold the first place in it. For not only by right of birth, but already by his own preparations, he was ready to seize power. Many of the officers, and many of his friends, stood ready, being men not unwilling to do or suffer anything whatsoever. On hearing this report, Herod was overcome entirely by both resentment and fear, taking the words spoken as insolence hard to bear, and those hinting at a plot as no less dangerous, so that he grew all the more inflamed from both directions, and, being a harsh man, was afraid that something truly stronger than he could guard against, by the time it came, might really be organized against him. From this point on, he no longer made his investigation openly, but sent out spies among those under suspicion. Suspicion and hatred toward everyone took hold of him, and, seizing on suspicion as a means of safety, he went on applying it freely even against those who did not deserve it. There was no end to it. The men reckoned to have influence seemed to him all the more to be feared the more powerful they appeared, while for those with whom he had no close relation, it seemed enough merely to name them, and at once they seemed to him to be losing part of his security. In the end, those around him, having nothing secure to hope for in the way of safety, turned against one another, thinking that if one man forestalled another by informing against him first, this would work toward his own safety. Yet they only made themselves objects of envy whenever they did obtain what they sought, and brought upon themselves, in addition, the just deserts of the wrongs they had done to others. Indeed, some were already pursuing private quarrels of their own in just this fashion, and, being caught out, found themselves suffering the same fate, treating the occasion as an instrument and a snare against their enemies, while being caught in the very trap by which they had schemed against others. For repentance came quickly to the king, because he was putting men to death without their guilt being made plain, and the difficulty of it was resolved not by his ceasing to act in the same way, but by his taking equal vengeance on those who had brought the accusations. Such was the disturbance surrounding the court. To many of his friends, he now gave notice that they should no longer present themselves to him or come into the palace. He issued this order against those toward whom the freedom he had once granted had been either lesser or greater. For Andromachus and Gemellus, men who had long been his friends, who had done great service to his house both on embassies and in council on matters of state, and who had helped raise his sons, and who, need one even ask, had held the very first place in that freedom of access, he now dismissed. The one because his son Demetrius was intimate with Alexander, and Gemellus, because he knew him to be well disposed toward Alexander, since he had shared in his upbringing and education, and had accompanied him on his stay in Rome. He dismissed these men too, though he would gladly have treated them still worse, restrained only by the fact that he could not, without disgracing men of no small standing, extend such freedom of access as far as this, thereby stripping away both their honor and their power to restrain him from wrongdoing. Antipater was responsible for all of this. Once he had discerned the sickness afflicting his father's willingness to listen freely to others, he had for a long time been pressing close upon him in counsel, and seemed to be accomplishing all the more of what he intended, one by one, whenever those able to stand against him were removed. So now, once Andromachus and his circle had been driven from any voice or freedom of speech, the king first put to torture as many as he supposed loyal to Alexander, to learn whether they knew of any daring plot against him, but they died having nothing to say. This became for him a further cause of contentiousness, that nothing such as he supposed should turn up on investigation, and Antipater, clever man that he was, sought to discredit as guilty, precisely through their innocence, a man whose self-restraint and loyalty was proved by the very truth, while working to inflame matters further, seeking out from ever more people whatever lay hidden in the scheme. Then someone among the many being tortured said that he knew the young man had often said, whenever he was praised for being tall of stature, a fine marksman with the bow, and superior to everyone in the other marks of excellence, that these were for him misfortunes rather than blessings given by nature. For his father, he said, was grieved and jealous over them, so that whenever he was out walking with him, he would draw himself in and stoop, so as not to appear taller. But when shooting at the hunts with his father present, he would deliberately miss the mark, for he knew his father's jealous pride whenever these things won him honor. As the man was tortured, and with the easing of pain, gained some relief in his body, he added further that Alexander, with his brother Aristobulus as his accomplice, planned to ambush his father during a hunt and then flee to Rome, and that once this was accomplished, he intended to ask for the kingdom for himself. Letters from the young man to his brother were also found, in which he complained that his father was acting unjustly, granting to Antipater land, yielding an income of 200 talents. On these grounds, Herod at once thought he had some solid proof, as he supposed, against the suspicion he held of his sons, and he had Alexander seized and put in chains. Even so, he did not relent from his harshness, though he did not entirely believe even what he had heard. For on reflection, nothing worthy of a plot appeared to him in these matters, only complaints and youthful ambitions, and it seemed implausible that a man who had openly killed his father would then rush off to Rome. He wanted to get some greater proof of his son's wrongdoing, and, being contentious by nature, he was unwilling to appear to have condemned him to chains rashly. So, torturing those of Alexander's friends who held office, he put not a few of them to death without their saying anything of what he supposed. With so much readiness for such measures, and fear and confusion prevailing around the palace, one of the younger men, as if under the pressure of necessity, said that Alexander was sending word to his friends in Rome, asking to be summoned there by Caesar as soon as possible. For he had, he said, a plot to reveal against Mithridates, the king of the Parthians, whom his father had chosen as a friend against the Romans, and that he also had poison prepared for him at Ascalon. Herod believed these things, and found some comfort for his own rashness amid his troubles, being flattered by worse men than himself. The poison, though eagerly sought at once, was not found. But Alexander, out of sheer contentiousness, wishing to make the extremity of these evils still worse, did not turn to denial, but instead met his father's rashness with a still greater fault of his own, perhaps also wishing by this means to shame his father's readiness to believe slanders, and not least in case he had actually resolved, should he be believed, to destroy both him and the whole kingdom. He wrote letters in four books and sent them, saying there was no need to torture anyone further or to go on with the investigation. For the plot was real, and its participants were Pheroras and his most trusted friends, and Salome too, who had come to him by night and lain with him against his will. And that all of them had come together to this end, that once they had gotten him out of the way as quickly as possible, they might be free from the constant expectation of it. Among those thus accused were also Ptolemy and Sapinius, the most trusted men of the king. And what need is there to say more? As if some madness had fallen upon them, men once dearest to one another became like wild beasts against each other, none of them allowing room for defense or examination until the truth could be established. But destruction without judgment continually falling on everyone alike, some to chains, others to death, others lamenting that these fates awaited them, while stillness and gloom stripped the palace of its former splendor. Herod's whole life became harsh, his entire existence in turmoil, and his refusal to trust anyone was itself a great punishment inflicted by his own expectation. Often, indeed, he imagined his son rising up against him or standing over him sword in hand, as if in a waking vision. So it was that his soul, working at this night and day, took on an affliction of madness and no less of derangement. Such was the state of affairs concerning him. The king of the Cappadocians, when he learned what had happened to Herod, was troubled on account of his daughter and the young man, and shared in his friend's distress over so great a disturbance. He came at once, not treating the matter as a minor affair. Finding things as they were, he judged it entirely unsuitable to the moment to rebuke Herod or to say that anything rash had been done, since a man already embittered would only contend the more, and one who hurried to defend himself would be filled with still greater anger. So Archelaus took a different course. He set about correcting the damage that had been done. Feigning anger at the young man, he called him blameless for having done nothing rash, declared that he would break off the marriage with Alexander, and said he would not even spare his own daughter if she had known of any wrongdoing and failed to disclose it. Since this was not at all what Herod had expected, and Archelaus showed the greater anger on Herod's own behalf, the king's harshness gave way. Feeling that he had gained a case for having acted justly, he gradually shifted back into a father's natural feeling. He was pitiable in both moods. When someone cleared the young man of the slanders, he was stirred again to anger. But when Archelaus joined in accusing him, he turned to tears and unfeigned grief. He began to beg Archelaus neither to dissolve the marriage nor to hold on to his anger over the wrongs the young man had done. Archelaus, taking this up more gently, shifted the blame onto Alexander's friends, saying that it was they who had corrupted him, since he was young and had no sense of malice. And in this way, he made Herod's brother Pheroras still more suspect. For Herod was harsh toward Pheroras too, and Pheroras, seeing no one else able to reconcile him, and finding no other recourse, turned to Archelaus, dressed in mourning black and bearing every mark of impending ruin. Archelaus did not dismiss his plea, but said he could not quickly change the king's mind while he was so disposed. It would be better for Pheroras himself to go and beg, admitting that he was the cause of everything, for in this way he would relieve the excess of Herod's anger, and Archelaus would be present to assist him. When Pheroras was persuaded, both matters were settled together. The slanders against the young man were unexpectedly lifted, and, having reconciled Pheroras, Archelaus set off for Cappadocia, having become, in that crisis, more welcome to Herod than any other man could have been. For this, Herod honored him with the most costly gifts and treated him magnificently in every other respect, holding him among his very dearest friends. He also arranged to travel to Rome with him, since Caesar had written concerning these matters, and the two journeyed together as far as Antioch. There Herod also reconciled the governor of Syria, Titius, who was at odds with Archelaus, and then returned to Judea. While he was in Rome, and after his return from there, war broke out against the Arabs for the following reason. The inhabitants of Trachonitis, once Caesar had taken the region from Zenodorus and given it to Herod, no longer had license to plunder, but were compelled to farm and live peaceably. This was not to their liking, nor did the land reward the labor of those who worked it. Still, at first, since the king would not permit it, they held back from wronging their neighbors, and Herod gained much good repute for his diligence in this. But when he sailed to Rome, the time when he also brought his accusation against his son Alexander, and had gone to present his son Antipater to Caesar, the men occupying Trachonitis spread word that he was dead, threw off his rule, and returned to their old habit of wronging the people around them. On that occasion, the king's generals subdued them while he was absent, but about 40 of the ringleading bandits, fearing what had befallen those who had been caught, abandoned the country and set out for Arabia, where Silius took them in after his failed marriage to Salome. He gave them a fortified place to settle in, and from there, overrunning not only Judea but the whole of Celesyria, they plundered it, while Silius supplied them with bases and immunity for their crimes. When Herod returned from Rome, he found that much of his own people's property had been damaged, and he was unable to get the bandits into his power because of the protection the Arabs afforded them. But deeply angered over the wrongs done to him, he went through Trachonitis and put their families to the sword. This only drove the bandits to greater fury over what they had suffered, and since they had a kind of law entitling them to pursue the killers of their kin by every means without penalty, they carried on ravaging the whole of Herod's realm. Herod, for his part, took the matter up with Caesar's governors, Saturninus and Volumnius, demanding that the bandits be handed over for punishment. Emboldened all the more by this, they grew still more numerous and threw everything into turmoil, aiming to bring down Herod's kingdom, sacking places and villages and slaughtering every man they seized, so that the lawlessness came to resemble open war, for they now numbered about 1,000. Distressed by this, Herod demanded the bandits back, and also demanded repayment of 60 talents he had lent to Abodas through Silius since the term of the loan had passed. But Silius, having pushed Abodas aside and taken charge of everything himself, denied that the bandits were in Arabia at all and kept putting off the question of the money, which was discussed before Saturninus and Volumnius, the governors of Syria. In the end, it was agreed through them that within 30 days Herod would recover the money, and each side would hand over any of the other's people found within its own kingdom. Among Herod's people, not a single Arab was found at all, whether as a wrongdoer or in any other capacity, while the Arabs were shown to be sheltering the bandits among themselves. When the deadline passed and Silius had fulfilled none of what was just, he went up to Rome. Herod then seized, as security, the money and the bandits held among the Arabs, and since Saturninus and Volumnius permitted him to proceed against those acting in bad faith, he led out an army into Arabia, covering 7 stages in 3 days, and on reaching the fortress that held the bandits, took it by storm and captured them all, razing the place called Repta. Nothing else was harmed. When the Arabs came out to relieve it under the command of Nasib, a battle followed in which few of Herod's men fell, but Nasib, the Arab general, and about 25 of his men fell, and the rest turned to flight. Having punished them, Herod settled 3,000 Idumeans in Trachonitis to keep watch over the bandits there, and sent word of all this to the governors, then in Phoenicia, showing that he had done nothing more than what was needed to proceed against the Arabs' bad faith. On close inquiry, they found that none of it was false. But messengers hurried ahead to Rome on Silius's behalf and reported what had happened, magnifying each event beyond its true measure, as one would expect. Silius had already made himself known to Caesar, and was at that time attending the court. As soon as he heard the news, he changed at once into black clothing, came before Caesar, and told him that Arabia had been ravaged by war and the whole kingdom laid waste, since Herod had attacked it with an army. Weeping, he said that 2,500 of the leading Arabs had perished, that their general Nasib, his own kinsman and relative, had been killed, that the wealth at Repta had been plundered, and that Abodas had been held in contempt for his weakness, unable to withstand the war because neither he nor the Arab forces had been present. As Silius spoke in this way, adding spitefully that he himself would never have left the country had he not trusted that Caesar cared for peace among all peoples, and that even his own presence there could not have made the war profitable for Herod, Caesar, provoked by what he heard, questioned Herod's representatives who were present, and his own men who had come from Syria, on this one point alone, whether Herod had led out the army. When they were forced to admit this much, but Caesar would not listen to why or how it had been done, his anger grew still greater, and he wrote to Herod harshly on other matters as well. But the chief point of the letter was this, that having once treated him as a friend, he would now treat him as a subject. Silius, too, wrote to the Arabs about these events. Emboldened, they neither surrendered the bandits who had escaped nor settled the debts, and they kept, without payment, the pasture lands they had leased from Herod, since the king of the Jews had been humbled by Caesar's anger. Those holding Trachonitis also took advantage of the moment, rising up against the Idumean garrison and joining the Arabs in banditry, plundering their territory, harsher in their wrongdoing not merely for gain, but out of spite as well. Herod bore all of this, since the freedom he had enjoyed through Caesar's favor had now changed, and the greater part of his confidence had been stripped away. For Caesar would not even receive the embassy Herod sent to defend himself, but sent the delegation home having achieved nothing. There was, in consequence, despondency and fear, and Silius, trusted and present in Rome, caused no small distress, laying hold now of still greater matters. For Abodas had died, and Aeneas, who took the new name Aretas, succeeded to the rule of the Arabs. Silius attempted, through slander, to push him aside and seize the throne for himself, giving large sums to those at court and promising much to Caesar besides. But Caesar was angry that Aretas had taken the kingship without first writing to him. Aretas, in turn, sent Caesar a letter and gifts, including a golden crown worth many talents. His letter accused Silius of being a wicked slave who had destroyed Abodas with poison and seized control while he still lived, of committing adultery with Arab wives, and of borrowing money in order to make the kingdom his own. Caesar paid no more attention to this than before, and sent him away without accepting any of the gifts. Meanwhile, affairs in Judea and Arabia went from bad to worse, some falling into disorder, and, as things were being destroyed, no one stood firmly in charge. One king had not yet secured his rule and so could not restrain wrongdoers, while Herod, for defending himself, was forced. Since Caesar's anger against him had flared so quickly, to endure every outrage committed against him. Seeing no end to the troubles surrounding him, Herod decided to send to Rome once more to see whether he could find some more moderate resolution, working through his friends and appealing to Caesar himself. It was Nicolaus of Damascus who went there. Meanwhile, his household and the affairs of his sons had also been thrown into confusion and had grown far worse around this same time. Even in the past, nothing had been free of anxiety, given how the greatest and most difficult of human sufferings so often threatens royal houses through the turns of fortune. But the trouble now advanced and grew even greater for the following reason. Eurycles of Lacedaemon, a man of some standing among his own people but base at heart, and skilled at both indulging in luxury and flattery and concealing that he did so, came to visit Herod. He gave him gifts, and, receiving still more in return, used his opportunities for private meetings to make himself one of the king's closest friends. His lodging was in Antipater's household, but his access and familiarity lay with Alexander, for he claimed to be devoted to Archelaus the Cappadocian. For this reason, he also pretended to honor Glaphyra and went about secretly courting everyone, always attentive to whatever was said or done, so as to trade on the resulting rumors. In the end, he turned out, for each person as the occasion required, to seem a friend to that one while appearing to the others to be siding only with whoever suited his own advantage. This man drew out Alexander, still young, and persuaded that he could speak freely of his grievances to no one but him, who unburdened himself, showing how his father had grown estranged from him, and recounting the treatment of his mother and the doings of Antipater, who, having pushed them aside from honor, now held all power. He said that none of this was bearable, now that his father had been so thoroughly turned against him that he could not even endure being present with him at banquets or gatherings. Such were his words, understandably, given what he suffered. But Eurycles carried these speeches back to Antipater, telling him that Alexander said such things not out of hostility to him, but because he felt outdone by him, given how greatly Antipater was honored, and he urged Antipater to be on his guard against Alexander, insisting that Alexander spoke none of this idly, but that his very words carried real intent. Antipater, believing Eurycles well disposed toward him because of this, rewarded him with great gifts at every turn, and at last persuaded him to carry the report on to Herod. Eurycles, in recounting what he claimed to have heard of Alexander's ill will, proved far from unconvincing. Rather, by constantly working on the king with his words and provoking him, he brought Herod to a point where the hatred became fixed beyond recall. He showed this at once. He gave Eurycles 50 talents as a gift on the spot. Eurycles, having taken the money, went up to Archelaus, king of the Cappadocians, and there praised Alexander, saying he had done Archelaus great service in bringing about the reconciliation with his father. Having drawn money from him as well, he departed before his double dealing could be discovered. Eurycles did not stop his wickedness even once back in Laestemon, and for his many crimes, was in the end stripped of his own homeland. The king of the Jews no longer behaved toward Alexander and Aristobulus, as he once had, merely listening to the slanders brought against them. Having now become hostile to them within his own household, he himself worked things out whether or not anyone spoke against them, watching everything, making inquiries, and giving free rein to anyone who wished to say something damaging about them, even allowing Evaristus of Cos to disclose what he claimed to know about Alexander. And this, above everything, Herod took with the greatest pleasure. A still greater plot then arose against the young men, since the slander against them was constantly being made to grow larger, and it seemed, as one might say, that a prize was set before everyone. To say something damaging about them was thought to serve the king's own safety. Herod had two bodyguards, honored for their strength and stature, Jucundus and Tyrannus. These men, having become resentful of the king now, had them pushed away from Alexander's circle, though they still rode with him and were honored at the gymnasium, and had received a sum of gold and other gifts. The king immediately grew suspicious of these two as well, and had them tortured. After holding out for a long time, they eventually said that Alexander had been urging them to kill Herod, since he would get his chance while out hunting. It would be easy to say the king had been thrown from his horse and impaled on his own spears, since something of the sort had in fact happened to him once before. They also produced the gold, which had been buried in a stable, and denounced the chief huntsman, who they said had given them royal spears and, on Alexander's orders, weapons to Alexander's attendants as well. After these two, the commander of the fortress of Alexandrian was arrested and tortured, since he too was accused of having agreed to receive the young men into the garrison and to supply them with the funds stored there for the king's use in that fortress. He himself admitted nothing, but his son came forward and said that this had indeed happened and produced a letter that appeared to be in Alexander's hand. "When, with God's help, we have accomplished all that we have proposed, we will come to you. Only try, as you promised, to receive us into the fortress." On being shown this note, Herod no longer had any doubt about his son's plot against him. Alexander, however, said that Diophantus, the secretary, had copied his handwriting, and that the note had been forged through Antipater's doing. For Diophantus was indeed known to be skilled at such things, and was later put to death after being convicted of other forgeries. The king brought those who had been tortured before the crowd at Jericho to denounce the young men, and the mob stoned them to death with their own hands. When the crowd surged forward to kill Alexander and his brother in the same way, the king held them back, through the intervention of Ptolemy and Pheroras, and had them instead placed under guard and watch. No one was allowed to approach them, but everything they did and said was closely monitored, and they suffered all the disgrace and fear of condemned men. One of them, Aristobulus, overcome with bitterness, urged his own aunt and mother-in-law to grieve with him over his misfortunes and to hate the man who had persuaded her to act as she had. "Is there not also a danger to you," he said, "now that you have been slandered to Silius in hope of marriage, in reporting everything that happens here?" She quickly carried these words to her brother. He could no longer restrain himself and ordered the two young men bound, and once they had been separated from each other, ordered them to write down and hand over an account of every wrong they had done against their father. When this was required of them, they wrote that they had never conceived or plotted any scheme against the man who begot them, but that they had planned to flee, and this only out of necessity, because their life had become suspect and difficult to bear. At this time, an envoy named Melas, a man of standing among Archelaus's people, arrived from Cappadocia on behalf of Archelaus. Wishing to demonstrate Archelaus's ill will toward him, Herod summoned Alexander from his bonds and again questioned him about the escape plan, where and how they had intended to withdraw. Alexander said that he had planned to go to Archelaus, and from there, once Archelaus agreed, to be sent on to Rome. He had entertained nothing else improper or troublesome against his father, nor was anything that his enemies had maliciously fabricated true. He said he wished still to live, if only to have Tyrannus and his companions examined more thoroughly, but that they had already been put to death sooner, because Antipater kept installing his own friends among the people. As he was speaking, Herod ordered that Melas and Alexander be brought to Glaphyra, Archelaus's daughter, and that she be asked whether she knew nothing of what was being plotted against Herod. When they arrived, Glaphyra, seeing Alexander in chains, struck her head at once and, overcome, cried out loudly in shared grief. There were tears from the young man, too, and the sight was painful for those present, so much so that for a good while they could neither say nor do what they had come for. At last Ptolemy, to whom the task of conducting Alexander had been assigned, ordered him to state whether his wife knew anything of what had been done. "What would she not have known?" he replied, "since she is loved by me more than my own life and shares in our children." At this, she cried out that she knew of nothing improper, but that if lying about herself would help save him, she would confess to everything. Alexander said, "There is nothing impious in it, nor anything of what those who least ought to suspect us have imagined. I myself never conceived it, and you know nothing of it, except that we had decided to withdraw to Archelaus and from there to Rome." When she admitted to this much, Herod, concluding that Archelaus's ill will toward him had been proven, gave letters to Olympus and Volumnius, instructing them, on their voyage, to put in at Eleusa in Cilicia and deliver them to Archelaus, reproaching him for having taken part in the young men's plot, and then to sail on from there to Rome. If they should find that Nicolaus had accomplished anything, so that Caesar was no longer displeased with him, they were to deliver the letters and the evidence he had drawn up against the young men. Archelaus, for his part, defended himself by admitting that he had received the young men, but said it was for their own good and their father's, so that nothing harsher might be added, in anger, to the suspicions over which they were already at odds. He had not, however, agreed to send them to Caesar, nor anything else out of ill will toward Herod. When they were brought to Rome, they found an opportunity to deliver the letters, only to discover that Caesar had already been reconciled with Herod, for the matter of Nicolaus's embassy had turned out as follows. When he arrived in Rome and came before the court, he asked to be heard not only on the matter for which he had come, but also to bring charges against Silius, and it was clear even before the hearing that the two men were at odds. The Arabs, suspecting this of him, went to Nicolaus and reported all of Silius's wrongdoings, offering clear proof that the whole of Abodas's estate had been squandered, for they even had some of Silius's own letters, which they had taken at the time of the revolt, and used to convict him through this evidence. Nicolaus, seeing that this good fortune had come his way, used it to further his purpose, pressing for a reconciliation between Herod and Caesar. For he knew well that if he wished to defend what Herod had done, he would not be granted freedom of speech, but that if he chose instead to accuse Silius, an opportunity would arise to speak in Herod's favor. So, once the two were set against each other, and a day appointed, Nicolaus, with Aretas's envoys present, brought a whole series of charges against Silius: that he was responsible for the death of the king and of many Arabs, that he had borrowed money for no honest purpose, and he exposed adulteries not only with women in Arabia, but also with women in Rome. He added, most seriously of all, that Silius had deceived Caesar by telling him nothing that was true about what Herod had done. When he came to this point, Caesar cut him off, insisting that he speak only to this: whether Herod had not led an army into Arabia, killed 2,500 of its people, taken prisoners, and plundered the country. To this Nicolaus replied that he would show, above all, that none of this, or at most very little of it, had happened as Caesar had heard, and that it would have been just to bear it harshly even if it had. When, to everyone's surprise, Caesar consented to hear him out, Nicolaus spoke of the loan of 500 talents and the contract, in which it was also written that once the deadline had passed, it was permitted to seize pledges from the whole country. The campaign, he said, was no campaign at all, but a just demand for one's own money, and not even that demand made hastily or beyond what the contracts allowed. Herod had gone repeatedly to Saturninus and Volumnius, the governors of Syria, and finally, at Berytus, in their presence, Silius had sworn by Caesar's own fortune that within 30 days he would hand over the money and the fugitives from Herod's kingdom. When Silius did none of this, Herod had gone again to the governors, and only when they permitted him to seize the pledges did he go forth, with difficulty, together with his own men. "This, then, was the war," Nicolaus said, as these men have made a tragedy of it, and this was the nature of the campaign. And how could it be called a war when your own governors had permitted it, the agreement had authorized it, and your own name, Caesar, along with those of the other gods, had been impiously violated? As for the prisoners, he went on, that must be spoken of next. Bandits from among those inhabiting the Trachonitis, 40 of them at first and then more, fleeing Herod's punishments, made Arabia their base. Silius took them in, supporting them beyond all men, gave them land to live off, and took for himself the profits of their banditry. He had also sworn, under the same oaths, to hand them over by the same deadline as the loan. He cannot at present show any other people of Arabia removed from their land besides these, nor even all of these, but only those who failed to escape notice. Thus, Caesar, you can see for yourself how the greatest and most invidious accusation, that of taking captives, turns out to be nothing but a fabrication and a lie devised to provoke your anger. For I say that when the Arabs' forces attacked us, and one and then a second of Herod's men fell, and Herod's men, defending themselves only with difficulty, killed Nechibos their commander, and about 25 men in all Silius, reckoning each one of these as 100, reported 2,500 dead. This moved Caesar all the more, and turning to Silius in a rage, he demanded to know how many Arabs had actually died. When Silius, at a loss, said he had been misinformed, the loan agreements were read out, along with the governor's letters and those of the cities that laid the blame on the bandits, and in the end Caesar's judgment came to this. He condemned Silius to death, and, reconciled with Herod, expressed regret for the harsher letter he had written him out of the bitterness caused by slander, and said something to the effect that Silius had forced him, through his false report, to be unjust toward a friend. In the end, Silius was sent back to answer the charges and repay his debts to his creditors before being punished. Caesar was not well disposed toward Aretas, because he had taken the throne on his own authority rather than through Caesar's grant. He had in fact decided to give Arabia to Herod, but the letters sent by Herod prevented it. For when Olympus and Volumnius, learning that Caesar was well disposed, thought it best at once to hand over, on Herod's instructions, the documents concerning his sons and the evidence against them, Caesar, on reading them, judged it would not be right to add another kingdom to an old man already in such trouble over his children. But he received Aretas's envoys, and, reproaching him only for his rashness in not waiting to receive the kingdom from Caesar himself, accepted his gifts and confirmed him in his rule. To Herod, now reconciled, he wrote that he was grieved over the matter of his sons, and that if they had attempted anything truly impious, he should proceed against them as against those who had raised their hands against their own father, for that authority was granted to him. But if they had merely planned to flee, he should admonish them and take no irrevocable action. He advised him to convene a council at Berytus, where Romans resided, and taking with him the governors and Archelaus, king of Cappadocia, and any others he judged distinguished for friendship and standing, to determine with their counsel what ought to be done. Such was Caesar's letter. When it was brought to him, Herod was overjoyed, both at the reconciliation and at being granted full authority over his sons. And somehow, while his earlier misfortune, hard as it was, had not made him bold or rash toward destroying his children, now, seizing on this turn for the better and this new freedom of action, he grew vain in the exercise of his power. He accordingly sent out summons to all whom he thought fit to call to the council, apart from Archelaus. Him he did not think fit to have present, out of enmity, or because he thought he would stand in the way of his purpose. When the governors and the others he had summoned from the cities had gathered at Berytus, he kept his sons, for he did not see fit to bring them before the council, in a village of the Sidonians called Platana, near the city, so that he could produce them if they were called for. He himself entered alone, and, before an assembly of 150 seated men, brought an accusation that was not one of grief, as might be expected from a man suffering such misfortune, but one very far removed from how a father should speak against his sons. It was violent, and in laying out his case he was in turmoil, giving the greatest signs of rage and savagery, not allowing the judges to examine the evidence for themselves, but instead presenting, on the son's behalf, a defense unworthy of a father speaking against his sons, and reading out what they themselves had written, in which no plot or thought of impiety had been recorded, only that they had planned to flee, along with certain reproaches against him arising from their ill will. As he read these out, he grew still louder, and turned what remained into an admission of the plot itself, swearing that he would rather be deprived of life than hear such words. Finally, he said that he held this authority both by nature and by Caesar's grant, and added that ancestral law also commanded that if parents, having accused someone, laid their hands upon his head, those standing by were required to stone him and put him to death in this way. This he said he was ready to do himself, in his own country and by his own royal authority. Yet he had chosen to wait for their judgment, though he had not come as though seeking judges for offenses that were plain, for which he had nearly suffered at his son's hands, but rather men who, having the opportunity to share his anger, would judge that no one, however distant, ought to overlook so grave a plot. When the king had said this, and the young men had not even been brought forward to answer the charge, those seated in the council, agreeing among themselves that gentleness and reconciliation would only make matters worse, confirmed his authority to act. And first Saturninus, a man of consular rank and among those of the highest standing, delivered his opinion, though in a most unpleasant position. He said he condemned Herod's sons, but did not think it right to have them killed, since he too had sons, and the calamity would be all the greater for him, even if everything had gone badly for him because of them. After Saturninus, his sons declared the same opinion, three legates who had accompanied him, and Volumnius said outright that men who had committed such impiety against their father should be punished with death. Most of those who spoke after them said the same, so that it no longer seemed to be anything other than that the young men had already been condemned to death. From there Herod went straight to Tyre, bringing them with him, and when Nicolaus sailed to him from Rome, he questioned him, after first describing what had happened at Berytus, about what opinion his friends in Rome held concerning his sons. Nicolaus said that what they had planned against Herod did indeed seem impious, but that he ought to confine and keep them under guard. And if he later decided to punish them, he should make sure it did not appear that he had acted more out of anger than judgment, while if he decided instead to release them, he should make sure the misfortune would not be beyond correction. This, he said, was also the opinion of most of Herod's friends in Rome. Herod fell silent and sank into deep thought, and then ordered Nicolaus to sail with him. When he arrived at Caesarea, there was at once talk everywhere among all the people about the sons, and the kingdom was in suspense, waiting to see where their case would finally turn. A terrible fear had come over everyone that after long factional strife things would arrive at their final outcome, and while they were distressed at what was happening, no one could safely say anything rash, nor listen safely to anyone else who did. But shut in as they were, they bore the excess of their grief painfully, yet in silence. One of them, however, a soldier of long standing named Tyro, whose son was of an age to be a friend of Alexander, could not, out of his outspoken nature, keep hidden what the others kept quietly concealed. Instead, he was driven to cry out often among the crowds, saying openly that truth had perished, that justice had been removed from among men, and that lies and malice now prevailed, casting so thick a cloud over affairs that even the greatest of human sufferings could no longer be seen by those responsible for them. Being the sort of man he was, he seemed to speak with reckless disregard for danger, yet the reasonableness of what he said stirred everyone, since he took his stand on the occasion not without courage. For this reason people gladly heard, spoken by him, everything each of them would have wished to say himself. And while they foresaw their own safety in keeping silent, they nevertheless welcomed his outspokenness. For the disaster they expected compelled everyone, through him, to speak on Alexander's behalf. He himself, pressing forward to the king with complete freedom of speech, insisted on speaking with him alone, and when this was granted but he could not bring himself to speak, he said, "O king, to endure in silence such suffering, though this bold outspokenness is dangerous, I have judged more useful and necessary for you than my own safety, if you should gain something profitable from it. Where have your good sense and your judgment gone, fallen out of your soul? Where is that extraordinary intelligence of yours, by which you accomplished many great things? What is this desolation of friends and kinsmen? I do not even judge those who are present to be kinsmen or friends, since they look on while such a horror is done to a kingdom once counted blessed. Will you not consider what is actually being done? You will kill two young men, born of a queen, men of the highest excellence in every virtue, and leave yourself in old age with a single son who has managed badly the hope placed in him, and with kinsmen on whom you yourself have already so often pronounced sentence of death. Do you not realize that even the silence of the crowds nevertheless sees this madness and hates the deed, and that the whole army and its leading officers feel pity for the unfortunate and hatred for those who are doing this? The king listened to this at first not altogether unreasonably, but why should I even say it? He was deeply stirred when Tyro touched openly on his suffering and on his mistrust of his own household. Then, little by little, the man went further, using an unmeasured and soldierly frankness, for his lack of restraint carried him beyond what the occasion allowed, and Herod was filled with confusion, and, feeling reproached rather than hearing words meant for his benefit. Especially once he learned of the soldiers' disposition and the officers' resentment, ordered that all those named be arrested, and that Tyro be bound and held under guard. When this had happened, a certain Trypho, a barber of the king's, seized the occasion as well, coming forward and saying that Tyro had often tried to persuade him, whenever he was shaving the king's throat with the razor, to cut it, for he would then be among the first around Alexander and would receive great gifts. Having said this, Herod ordered him arrested, and after this there was torture of Tyro, of his son, and of the barber. While Tyro held out under it, his son, seeing his father now in a wretched state and with no hope of safety, foreseeing from the severity being inflicted on the sufferer what awaited himself as well, said he would reveal the truth to the king if he would spare both himself and his father further torture and abuse by his telling it. When the king had given his word on this, he said there was a plot for Tyro to attack the king with his own hand, since it was easy for him to approach him alone, and that in doing so and suffering whatever was likely to follow, he would not act ignobly, but would be doing Alexander a favor. Having said this, he freed his father from the compulsion, though it is unclear whether he was forced to speak the truth, or whether he had thought of this as a way of ending the suffering for himself and for the one who had begotten him. Herod, if he had earlier had any hesitation about the killing of his children, any room or place left for it in his soul, now had none at all, having removed everything that might have afforded him a change of mind toward better reasoning. He hastened at last to bring his resolve to its conclusion. Bringing before an assembly 300 of the officers who had been implicated, along with Tyro, his son, and the barber who had informed against him, he brought accusations against all of them. The crowd, pelting them at once with whatever came to hand, killed them. Alexander and Aristobulus were taken to Sebaste on their father's order and strangled there, and their bodies were carried by night to Alexandrian, where their maternal grandfather and most of their ancestors lay buried. Now perhaps it does not seem unreasonable to some that a hatred nurtured over a long time should grow in this way, and, advancing further, overcome nature itself. But a question might reasonably arise as to whether such a cause should be traced back to the young men, on the ground that they provoked their father to anger, and over time, brought him to an incurable harshness toward themselves, or rather to Herod himself, since he was a man untouched by restraint and extraordinary in his desire for power, and for the rest of his reputation, so much so that no one supposes he left anything undone by which he might make whatever he wanted unassailable. Or else one might say that fortune had a power greater than any sound reasoning, whence we are also persuaded that human affairs are consecrated beforehand by her to the necessity that they come about absolutely. And we call this fate, as though nothing existed that did not come about through her. This argument, however, as reaching too far toward that conclusion, will suffice for us to raise only in passing, granting something to ourselves as well, and not leaving the differences among ways of life unaccountable, matters that have already been philosophized about before us, and by the law as well. Of the other two causes, one might reproach the sons with an accusation arising from youthful self-will and royal pride, in that they tolerated slanders against their father and were not kindly examiners of the way he conducted his life, being prone to suspect the worst and unrestrained in speaking of it, and thus easily caught, on both counts, by those who watched them and reported for favor. The father, however, does not seem worthy of any mitigation for his impiety toward them, since, without having received clear proof of a plot or being able to demonstrate any preparation for an attempt, he dared to kill his own offspring, men outstanding in body and longed for by all who were not even his own, and no way inferior in their pursuits, whether it were a matter of hunting, or training for war, or speaking on behalf of those who had fallen into misfortune. For they took part in all of these, and Alexander the elder even more so. It would have sufficed even if he had condemned them to keep them alive nonetheless, in bonds or in exile from the kingdom, with great safety for himself, surrounded as he was by the power of Rome, through which he could suffer nothing even from open assault and force. But to kill them quickly, for the pleasure of the passion overpowering him, is proof of unmeasured impiety, and he erred greatly in this, being already advanced in age. Yet the delay and the passing of time would not bring him any pardon either. For to rush, stirred and shaken, into some monstrous act, though a harsh thing, is at least something that always happens. But to pause and deliberate at length, often setting out and often hesitating, and in the end to undertake and carry it through, is the mark of a bloodthirsty soul, hard to turn back from the worst course. He showed this also in what followed, not sparing even the rest of those who seemed dearest to him, in whose case justice made less claim to pity for those who perished, but the cruelty was just the same, in that he spared none of them either. We will go on to narrate these things in the account that follows.